I think it's the most unique thing is you can get it checked, but it's also the scale of it.
Alaska has one of the most generous oil tax credit programs in the world. Some experts say it's time to scale the credits back. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 30th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, the legislative effort to shut down what one advocate calls the victim-making factory.
We just keep unleashing the same criminals ready to commit crimes against our citizenry.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans and communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
With less than a month left in the legislative session, one of the biggest questions facing lawmakers is oil tax credits. These credits are now the third largest line item in the state budget, behind only the Departments of Education and Health and Social Services. Many argue Alaska can no longer afford these kinds of subsidies. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. Oil tax credits sound complicated and boring, and you're switching the channel to Justin Bieber. But don't do it, because oil tax credits are actually super interesting and super important. Between this year and next, the state is expected to pay out more than $1 billion in credits to oil and gas companies. That amounts to half of all the revenue the state is taking in from the industry during the same time. And that is pretty unusual. Tim Bradner is a longtime energy reporter who also writes the Alaska Legislative Digest. He says nobody else in the world offers a program quite like this.
It started out as a good idea, but incrementally got more and more complicated to the point that it's difficult to understand and difficult to control and way too expensive. Even if we had the money, it's just way too expensive.
And so with the state facing a $4 billion budget deficit, Governor Bill Walker has proposed cutting some credits and capping others. But so far, lawmakers have preferred much smaller cuts. First, though, let's talk about what oil and gas tax credits are. The state of Alaska wants companies to explore for oil and gas, and it wants new companies to come into the state. To encourage that, it instituted a system of credits.
And it was simple in those days, but the concept was that you could give a company a little bit of a tax break to encourage them to go drill, spend money in exploration that they might not have otherwise spent, and find more oil and gas that way.
And in theory, at least, the state would make more money on the back end in taxes and royalties than it invested in the front end. That sounds simple enough. But what if you don't owe any taxes? For a small company that's never operated in Alaska and isn't producing any oil, they need a different incentive. And one major goal for lawmakers was to bring smaller companies into the state to go after smaller pools of oil the big three North Slope producers aren't interested in. So in 2007, the state made some credits refundable. This is basically a check the state mails you to reimburse you for doing things the state likes. You drill a well, the state will pay part or even most of the cost of that well.
You could make the investment, drill your wells, turn in your certificates, your tax credit certificates to the state, and get a check from the state, and you could use that to finance your next year's drilling.
Only smaller companies are eligible for a refundable credit. The big producers, like ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, can use credits to reduce their taxes, but they don't get a check in the mail. And when we say the state is spending $1 billion on credits this year and next, we're just talking about the checks. One more thing about credits. The system was designed with high oil prices in mind.
And at the time, you know, we had plenty of money.
Right, and the goal was to take some of what the state was raking in taxes and reinvest it in the oil industry. But now, of course, oil revenue has plummeted. Meanwhile, over the years, credits have grown.
It seems like each year somebody would have a new idea, and the thing became kind of like a Christmas tree, to the point that nobody really quite, it was very difficult to understand how it all worked.
And a company can add some credits together to the point that the state might pay more than two-thirds of the cost of certain work. That's what makes it so unusual, Bradner says.
I think it's the most unique thing is you can get a check, but it's also the scale of it.
Bradner says just about anywhere else, if the government is funding 60 or 70% of your costs, they would then own part of that well. So the big question is it a good investment? Bradner says it's hard to know. Would the companies have explored anyway?
That's the unknowable. The companies on the North Slope argue that the tax credits help them. You'll never really know if that's the case, but the fact is you got wells drilled that may or may not have gotten drilled.
Certainly, many smaller companies have come into Alaska, and explorers like Armstrong Drilling on the North Slope or Blue Crest Energy in Cook Inlet say the credits were a major draw. But here's the catch. The state has spent more than $3 billion since 2007, and we don't actually know where that money has gone. For instance, at some point in the last 9 years, one company in 1 year received more than $200 million. That's a lot of money. It's more than half of state spending on the University of Alaska. And it went to one company. So what was it for?
That's an easy one, Rachel. We can disclose nothing.
That's Ken Alper, director of the state tax division. Most specifics about credits are protected as confidential taxpayer information. The governor wants to change that, to disclose which companies receive credits, how much they get, and roughly what they use it for. Alper says this is key.
We've spent close to $3.5 billion now on refundable tax credits and could only give vague hints over who and what types of companies and what benefits we've got from that level of state investment.
But companies worried that the provision as written could reveal too much proprietary information, so it was left out by the House Resources Committee. House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Nikiski Republican, says he's not sure there's a point to more disclosure.
The state knows who it is. The state knows how much was invested. The state knows all that information. And sometimes I just wonder, is that really information that every Alaskan's just dying to know?
The House Resources Committee also scaled back the governor's cuts. Where the governor's bill imposed a cap of $25 million per company per year, House Resources raised it to $200 million. And while the governor proposed ending some credits right away, the committee wants to step down credits over 18 months. The result? Over the next 3 years, the committee's bill would save a fraction of the governor's version. Chenault says he worries about yanking the rug out from under companies and threatening future oil production.
My concern is if you pull everything away today, how much, if any, investment is going to happen in the next few years?
The bill has several more stops in the legislature before reaching the House and Senate floors. Chenault says at this point, his only prediction is that the bill will change. Okay, now you can go back to Justin Bieber. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
My friends say I'm a fool to think that you're the one for me. I guess I'm just a sucker for love.
What the legislature does in response to the state's government's $4 billion deficit could have big effects on Alaska's economy. That's according to a leading economist. Gunnar Knapp directs the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research. He told the Senate Finance Committee today that uncertainty over the budget is a concern for the entire economy. Knapp says closing the budget gap in 1 year could be too much, too fast. But it's important for the state to have a plan.
If you can, in fact, reduce the uncertainty, then it makes more sense to implement, you know, things over time. But there's all the difference in the world between that and saying, okay, we fixed, you know, 30% of the problem and we'll get back to you on what comes next.
Knapp says the state isn't in recession yet, but appears to be heading into one. Job losses in the oil and gas industry, construction, and state government have been offset by gains in healthcare and hospitality.
I would say that regardless of what you do, I think it's very unlikely that the recession we will be facing would be as severe or damaging as the 1980s recession.
Knapp says that's because the economy is bigger, more diverse, and less overextended with borrowing and construction than it was in the 80s. Knapp urged lawmakers to focus on major issues, like making changes to the permanent fund earnings and finding new revenue.
My own instincts are that you can't get there without new revenues.
Governor Bill Walker has proposed a personal income tax. Legislative leaders have so far resisted the proposal. Fairbanks Republican Senator Pete Kelly says he doesn't want to raise taxes until the legislature has done more to cut the size of government.
If we're getting into the discussion of the things that begin to affect the flat rate mechanic in my district about whether he or she should pay taxes and start giving up the fruits of their labors, that has to be done later after we have made sure everything else about government is on the table. Then we'll start talking about the things that are on their table.
Kelly questioned whether Knapp's emphasis on having a state fiscal plan to reduce uncertainty was influenced by Governor Bill Walker. In response, Knapp said he realizes lawmakers face difficult decisions, but he's trying to stay out of the politics on either side of the issue. State officials in Alaska are proposing a program to address high-cost health insurance claims in hopes of stabilizing rising rates on the individual policy market. Just two companies serve the individual market in Alaska and have filed for double-digit rate increases each of the last 2 years. State officials say that's not sustainable. They hope that reviving a high-risk pool to handle claims for the costliest conditions will bring some relief. The idea is to spread the cost of those claims across all insured markets rather than being borne by the smaller individual market. Division of Insurance Director Lori Wing Heyer told lawmakers that without a change, the state runs the risk of the individual market going into a death spiral, with people forced from the market by the high rates. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the UAA women's basketball team prepares to compete for the Division II national title.
I'm just excited to play. I was counting the sleeps till our game last night, and so I'm just ready to go.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Senate Bill 91, the Omnibus Crime Bill, is working its way through the Senate Finance Committee. In its current form, it would save the state about $150 million over the next 5 years, but about $100 million of that would be reinvested into programs aimed at making the community safer. The bill is based on suggestions from the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. When Lieutenant Chris Sell with the Juneau Police Department was appointed to that commission in 2014, she was focused on one thing, being tough on crime.
Because it's an awesome message. It feels great to be tough on crime. Nobody likes crime.
Sell says she would go to crime scenes where the suspects were repeat offenders and think that if only the perpetrator had been kept in prison longer, the crime wouldn't have happened. So she didn't want to do things that seemed like they would help criminals. But she also knew that the recidivism rate in Alaska was more than 60%.
We are a victim-making factory in this state. We just keep unleashing the same criminals ready to commit crimes against our citizenry.
After joining the commission and reviewing national data, Sell says she changed her tune. She realized being tough on crime with harsher penalties wasn't really a deterrent for the offenders.
They're not sitting down and doing a cost-benefit analysis before they commit a crime.
Sell says ultimately, the criminal justice system needs to get to the root of the issues that lead people to commit crimes by treating things like substance abuse and mental illness. The bill's main sponsor, Senator John Coghill of Fairbanks, says SB 91 offers multiple tools to do just that, and one starts before a person is even convicted. The basic idea is this. When someone is arrested, they take a risk assessment. Low-risk offenders who have good potential for rehabilitation are given alternatives to incarceration time. Those include monitoring to make sure they're held accountable for their actions. This, combined with reductions in sentence and probation time for some types of offenders, as well as other justice system reforms, will save the state about $100 to $150 million over the next 5 years. About two-thirds of those savings will then be reinvested into programs like substance abuse and sex offender treatment, making them available to people already in prisons and halfway houses. SB 91 includes incentives to entice people to participate.
The programs are going to be helpful for people to change their behavior. Those who won't change their behavior, the jail is going to have to be their lot. Those who will change and be more productive, that's a better society, and that's what we're aiming at.
Money will also go toward community-based treatment, domestic violence prevention, and victim services. The bill also calls for beefing up supervision for people on probation or parole and are at the highest risk for reoffending. The ideas are based on programs instituted by other states that have reduced both crime and recidivism. Brenda Stanfill is the executive director of the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living, a victims advocacy group, and a member of the Justice Commission. She says she knows the changes, like reduced sentences and probation times, seem frightening at first.
We really thought that we could criminalize our way out of a social issue. And I think what we have to recognize is that people are being victimized because we have some extensive social issues that we need to address. That our current prisons are not. They don't have programming in prison. They're not getting the services they need. And we're not making a difference when they go back out.
She says, from her perspective, it doesn't help victims to have offenders sitting around all day playing cards and reading. If their sentences are shorter, but they're given the tools to rehabilitate, then it will make the community safer. For both Stanfill and Lieutenant Sell, the reinvestment portion of the bill is one of the keys to making it effective. Here's Sell again.
Unless you do that reinvestment, don't pass this bill. Because if you pass only the part of the bill that saves money and don't do the reinvestment, all you're going to do is make our current revolving door spin faster.
The 107-page long bill is currently being reviewed by the Senate Finance Committee, which will take public testimony on Friday. A camp constructed by the U.S. Navy on a sea ice floe in the Arctic was evacuated last week. As KNOM's Emily Russell reports, the camp's early closure coincided with a new record low sea ice extent in the Arctic.
Located about 200 miles off the coast of Prudhoe Bay, the camp was host to American sailors and scientists from around the world. The Navy has held its ICE exercise, or ICEX for short, to test military readiness and conduct scientific research in the far north every few years since 1960. Commander Tommy Crosby is the public affairs officer for the Navy's submarine forces.
The camp itself is a temporary camp that is built on an ice floe that is moving. And with currents and wind direction and ice rubbing up against each other and moving, cracks do form and refreeze.
The Navy's exercise was scheduled to wrap up at the end of this week, but Crosby says changes in sea ice caused the camp to close early.
We had a crack that got close to camp and just deemed it for the safety of everyone. It would be out of abundance of caution that we demobilize a little bit earlier.
The crack shouldn't come as a big surprise. Last week, the National Snow and Ice Data Center reported the lowest maximum sea ice extent in the Arctic in satellite history. Ted Skambos is the center's lead scientist. He says warmer than normal temperatures in the region led to the record low.
It was unusually warm near the North Pole, up to 6 degrees centigrade. And when you're averaging 3 months, having something like a 11 or 12 degree above average mean temperature is a huge deal.
Scambo says the warmer temperatures didn't just affect the sea ice extent.
Not only did the ice not spread out very far from the Arctic Ocean and out into the Bering and the North Atlantic, but it also is probably thinner than it has been in decades past.
The U.S. Navy should expect thinner ice conditions. This year's early closure mirrors what happened 2 years ago, almost to the day, when rapidly changing sea ice forced them to pack up ahead of schedule. The camp's more than 200 participants were evacuated safely. The two submarines involved in ICEX will continue their operations under the thinning Arctic sea ice through early April. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Researchers say Pavlov volcano is still rumbling and exploding, but is no longer sending up massive ash clouds. U.S. Geological Survey geologist Chris Way-Thomas says there's still elevated seismicity, and the little explosions probably indicate lava fountaining at the summit. Pavlov began erupting Sunday, sending up massive ash clouds and disrupting some flights. Alaska Airlines resumed normal operations today. Way-Thomas says clouds now surround the top of the 8,000-foot volcano. He says eruptions could stop abruptly or go on for months. Pavlov erupted intermittently for more than 2 years, from April 1986 to August 1988.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Marine Conservation Council is committed to protecting the long-term health of Alaska's marine ecosystems and sustaining the waterfronts of our coastal communities. Learn more at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The University of Alaska Anchorage's women's basketball team is playing in the program's first ever NCAA Division II National Championship game next week. As Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports, the Seawolves will face off against Lubbock Christian in Indianapolis.
Coach Ryan McCarthy took the reins of the UAA women's basketball program in 2012, and the team has seen consistent improvement every season since. But McCarthy says this is the first year he and his team talked about winning a national championship from day one.
Maybe that's me being young and naive. I never thought, man, I really think we're the best team in the country. But this year, I really believed it. I really believed it. And I think more importantly, the girls that were playing believed it. And I think they believe that right now.
The Seawolves have 38 wins, an NCAA Division II record, and two losses this season. Despite the impressive record, McCarthy says all the pressure is on their opponent, undefeated Lubbock Christian.
They're the team that's undefeated. Everyone says they're number one in the nation. And so if they lose, people are going to ask them what happened. If we lose, no one's going to ask us that question because they're the number one team. It'd be an upset if we win. So we weren't even number one for our own region. So I'm excited. I think we get to be loose and come in there and play our game.
The players agree with that sentiment. Junior forward Alicia Devine, a Wasilla High School graduate, says after 40 games, the jitters are gone and it comes down to preparation.
Coach told us, you're not nervous if you're prepared. And I really think that we are prepared and we are preparing within the next few days too. It'll just keep getting us more confidence and we're in a great place right now. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm sure the nerves will get there before the game, but all the preparation will pay off.
And with 11 days between games, which is unusual in a collegiate basketball season, the Seawolves have plenty of time to rest and prepare. Senior guard Jenna Buchanan, a Galena High School grad, says it has not quite sunk in yet that she and her teammates will be playing in the biggest game of their career in less than a week.
I think it's exciting. I haven't really given much thought to how big a stage it is, really. I think I'll do that once we get there. But I'm just excited to play. I was counting the sleeps till our game last night, and so I'm just ready to go.
And with only a few sleeps left to go before the big game, Coach McCarthy says the countdown has begun. Not just for the season, but for the college careers of Jenna Buchanan and the team's other seniors.
After this, it's done. It's over. That's the way America works. And no more playing college basketball. But what a great way to end it on the grandest stage of them all.
The UAA women's basketball team will play against Lubbock Christian for the NCAA Division II National Championship in Indianapolis on Monday at 11 a.m. Alaska time. The game will be aired live on the CBS Sports Network, which is only available in Alaska on an expanded Dish Network package or DirecTV. If you don't have either of those, a dozen places around Anchorage plan to air the game. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Members of a University of Alaska Fairbanks mountaineering class are recovering after being hit by an avalanche in the eastern Alaska range. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the incident has raised questions about the university taking students into the mountains.
The McCallum Peak climbing trip was the culmination of an 11-week University of Alaska Fairbanks mountaineering course. UAF spokeswoman Marmion Grimes says the group, which included 9 students and 4 instructors, was climbing up the Canwell Glacier off the Richardson Highway Saturday when the slide triggered.
Some people were partially buried in the snow. Some were on top of the snow. There were 2 people that had their faces covered. The climbers who were free of the snow assisted them very quickly, uncovered their faces within the first about 20 or 30 seconds.
Grimes says no one was seriously injured, but the climb was abandoned and the group returned to Fairbanks. UAF Director of Adventure, Recreation and Wellness Programs, Mark Oldmixon, says group instructors initially experienced conditions that appeared to be okay.
They didn't find any red flags, natural avalanches or whoomping or shooting cracks.
A weekend Alaska Alpine Club trip to the same area was canceled. Volunteer leader Kelly O'Brien says she didn't feel comfortable with conditions given recent weather.
Reviewing the history of the winter in Alaska and knowing that we've had strange snow and that it's been unconsolidated, and then to have the temperature so warm followed up by that fresh snowfall that passed through, I just had the sixth sense that it just was not stable conditions.
O'Brien refers to a forecast posted earlier in the week to the Eastern Alaska Range Avalanche Center website warning of instability. Oldmixon, who's actively involved in the online center, maintains the forecast was stale.
It shouldn't be something that we necessarily use as a go, no-go 5 days later. So we felt comfortable still sending the trip.
Alaska Avalanche Information Center Education Coordinator Sarah Carter was in the area teaching courses the prior weekend, and some of her students posted the forecast. Carter agrees conditions shift quickly and are localized, but cautions that the Eastern Alaska Range snowpack has become generally less stable in recent years due to warmer weather.
With the warmer systems moving through, there are multiple layers of stronger snow with facets between those layers.
Carter notes basic techniques like only exposing one group member at a time to a slope to reduce risk, but she insists on not laying blame relative to the UAF avalanche incident.
There is an element of luck in the mountains.
UAF's Oldmixon says his initial takeaway from the weekend accident is that the class fell victim to rapidly changing conditions common in the mountains.
My initial instinct is that we didn't do anything wrong.
These accidents will occur, and this one, there could have been 13 deaths.
Jeff Benowitz is an experienced local alpinist and longtime UAF climbing gym instructor.
The University of Alaska should not be in the mountain guide business. We should offer mountaineering skill classes, and we can do that on campus, and we do it very well.
The university's Oldmixon says the avalanche incident will undergo thorough review and could result in program changes, but the initial priority is helping those involved recover from the intense slide incident. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Russell in Nome, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. If you're looking for a career that will put you to work immediately without any educational debt, think about the apprenticeship program and learn to become a construction craft laborer. The construction industry requires hard work, provides great pay, and a bright future while building Alaska. Application deadline for the apprenticeship program is March 31st. Call to begin your debt-free career track today, 907-345-3853. This message sponsored by Alaska Laborers Training School.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.